KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Today, we're revisiting my 2021 conversation with the co-creator of the FX comedy show Reservation Dogs. Before that series, Sterling Harjo directed three micro-budgeted films in his home state of Oklahoma. He'd knocked on Hollywood's door, but somehow he never could find any financing.
I heard that multiple times, that Native films don't make money. You know, I even heard like, well, this film's just a little too Indian, you know, or like, this film's not Indian enough. We don't know where to kind of categorize it, you know? So it was very confusing.
Harjo tells us about almost leaving the industry entirely before teaming up with longtime friend Taika Waititi to create Reservation Dogs, a quirky coming-of-age comedy with an almost entirely indigenous cast and crew. The show is now in the hunt for Emmy nominations. You can watch season one on Hulu, and season two is coming later this year. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
So, let's talk about Disney. Let's just call it the streaming banter from now on until somebody makes us talk about something else. Although we did talk about an actual movie that's going to play in theaters recently, Top Gun. So, I guess.
We can talk about how Disney is bragging about how customers at their parks are paying 40% more per person when they visit the parks than they were in 2019, which they are touting as a great thing. And I would say is the death of the middle class America. But that's a whole separate topic.
Disney did report second quarter results. They were good, but also confusing in terms of the messaging. The stock sort of went up and then it went back down because it's confusing. And I think it's confusing to be at one of these companies right now. Disney Plus had added, they said they had almost 138 million subscribers now with a gain of 8 million more or less in the second quarter. Bob Chapek, the CEO, then reiterates the forecast that they will have 230 to 260 million Disney Plus subscribers by the end of 2024. That is a hugely ambitious number. And then, you know, the stock, as I said, went up and then like cooler minds prevailed, especially because Disney's CFO then warned that the rate of growth in the latter part of this year may not be as strong as they had hoped. So he is sticking to this number, Chapek, very aggressive number, but you know, Netflix isn't that big and Netflix is at a wall.
Yeah, and the entire streaming video ecosystem has slowed, which is why the market turned on the business in the first place. So Chapek is trying to say two different things here. He's saying that, yes, we are still on track to grow. But the problem he has is that the average revenue per user for Disney Plus is extremely low. And it's dependent on, you know, people who watch cricket in India, where, you know, the rights there are up for renewal and it's unclear whether Disney will renew that. And they have given away a lot of subscribers thanks to their Verizon deal and some of the other freebies that they have done. So Chapek has to basically dramatically increase the number of people that are subscribing to Disney Plus while also trying to increase the amount that they are paying for Disney Plus. And that is a tough, tough line to walk.
Yeah. They will come on with an ad-supported tier later and, you know, hoping to increase subscribers and revenue. I just have to say for these companies that Wall Street is crazy making. They were all in on streaming. You were the biggest failure, sucker, loser in the world if you didn't open up a vein, a big important vein to support your streaming service. And then Netflix hits a bump. And Netflix is, I mean, a big bump. Let's not sell that short, a huge bump. But you know, these companies like Disney and like its competitors, they still have room to grow. You know, there's a lot of talk about what happened with Netflix and why. But the question is Wall Street even going to reward them for what they're able to accomplish? Or is now, what is the flavor of the month? They think in such short-term little bursts.
Well, right now they're thinking of the financials, the underpinnings of these businesses. And they're openly questioning whether spending billions and billions of dollars to grow these subscriber bases is the most effective use of that money. And that's hilarious if you have heard what they've been saying for the past 10 years, but it is the reality right now, which is why all of these streaming companies are saying, yes, we're going to spend, but we're going to spend responsibly. And you're seeing, you know, places like Netflix and HBO Max, they're focused on the fact that they have high revenue per user, which again puts more pressure on Disney and Bob Chapek because he doesn't have high revenue per user.
Because the price point is low.
The price point was low. And if you talk to the Chapek people, they complained that they were sort of hamstrung by Bob Iger and the previous regime who priced Disney Plus extremely low in order to grow quickly and create the impression that Disney was a true competitor to Netflix, which for the most part, it has grown exponentially and they get credit for that. It has grown with this ticking time bomb of financials behind it, and they have to figure that out now.
Meanwhile, Netflix, which let's just go through the Netflix cycle of life here. For many years, as you well know, ad supported, never in a million years. All of a sudden, ad supported. We're going to get to that, which has now become, we're going to try and get to that later this year, which is incredibly accelerated. And I'm not sure that it's not so simple to wave a wand. I'm not sure how they do it.
Right. And this is a company that has zero experience with the ad business. I mean, think of a company like Disney, which has also said they're going to have ads by the end of the year. Disney has decades of experience selling advertising across linear television networks. They can do this and they have the people and the relationships in place. Netflix is going to have to farm this out. And there's already some talk about who they might do that with. But they can't just flip the switch like some of these other companies can. It's going to be a big, big haul. And there's a lot of questions that we still don't know the answers to about how that will actually work and how the customer will see these ads.
Yes. I think that if they do it with a light touch, then that might be better because, you know, Netflix people have been trained to expect no ads. And even if they buy that lower price tier, I somehow feel like it would be more irritating to see it there than on Hulu because you weren't sold that it would never happen on Hulu. In another attempt to bolster its business, Netflix is, as we've already talked about, saying that they're going to go crack down on password sharing. And this is another place where, you know, Netflix is already pretty expensive. I think it's the most expensive of all the services. I think it runs $15.99 a month. And so they have apparently been fooling around with this, already testing it out in some other markets overseas. And, you know, you get a thing saying, we noticed that somebody is sharing your password and here's the upcharge. And it, you know, it may be a couple of bucks, it may be more than a couple of bucks, but just based purely anecdotally on the grumbling I hear and see on social media, I sort of feel like that extra message saying, oh, I see that your kid had graduated from college and moved to a different state, so pay us more. I just don't think that lands with a lot of people very well. If they're looking for a reason to drop the service, it makes it simpler.
Yeah, and that's the bet they're making. They're saying that they believe that there's enough incremental revenue in capturing some more money from these people to put their kids in college or the ex-boyfriend or whoever is sharing your Netflix password onto your account. That's going to outweigh the people who might get upset about this and maybe cancel the entire thing or move to a lower cost tier if you have an ad-supported tier. I mean, that's the big question here because both Disney and HBO Max and Netflix, they all have, by the end of the year, they'll all have ad-supported tiers. And the difference is Disney is probably going to charge more to people who want to eliminate the ads, whereas Netflix is going to probably say to people, you can pay less if you accept the ads. That's a very different proposition. And I think a lot of people who are perhaps watching Netflix less, they're going to say, you know what? I'm not watching Netflix that much. Why don't I just switch to the ad tier, pay $10 a month or whatever it is, and that's going to decrease their subscriber revenue significantly. Maybe they make it up on the ads, maybe they don't. But it's a big risk throwing this pivot after all these years.
And I just want to note, I'm looking at a 2017 tweet from Netflix saying, love is sharing a password. Turns out that it may be love, but you're going to pay for that love and to show your love.
That love is turning into an abusive ex.
Well, let's just say one that breaks some promises. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. In the FX comedy series Reservation Dogs, high school friends Bear and Alora dream of getting out of small town Oklahoma and moving to California. In the first episode, now streaming on Hulu, the friends seize an opportunity to make some extra cash when a delivery driver steps away from his truck full of spicy potato chips.
Put your seatbelt on.
Seatbelt?
Oh, people say
we're stealing a
chip. I do not get that. Put your seatbelt on.
Jesus Christ. Okay, weirdo.
Ultimately, Bear and Alora's plans for escape get pushed off to another day. They and their friends have plenty to deal with at home on the reservation, including a rival gang encroaching on their turf. Reservation Dogs features an almost entirely indigenous cast, as well as an all-native writing team. That makes it the first of its kind, and co-creator Sterling Harjo hopes it won't be the last. Harjo came up with the idea for Reservation Dogs with his longtime friend, Taika Waititi. When Waititi went off to make the next Thor movie, Harjo had to take on show running the series on his own with many questions about how to do that job. Harjo and Waititi first met through Bird Running Water, the longtime director of indigenous programs at the Sundance Institute, where Harjo was selected for a fellowship in 2004.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bird basically was kind of almost curating and pulling different artists together and really growing this like indigenous film community. And, you know, through the support of Sundance, I went out to the Sundance Labs and then I was at the festival. And Taika and I met because he had also been one of the people that Bird worked with over the years and also went to the labs. And Taika and I met, you know, at some of Bird's get-togethers and functions. And really, that's how we became friends and just remained friends after that because of the indigenous sort of film circuit.
You were making films and a doc all in Oklahoma where you wanted to work. That was a deliberate choice.
Yes. I mean, you know, I've always sort of been stubborn in that I didn't want to leave here. And, you know, I always looked up to filmmakers like Richard Linklater that stayed in their communities and helped those communities grow as well. And so I always wanted to do that here in Oklahoma. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, you know, along the way, I was told a lot of times that I wouldn't be able to do that. You know, I think that it's very rare that people try to do that. And so, you know, I was told numerous times that that was impossible, that I would have to move to LA. I just never did. And I just made my films here. And honestly, it was like, I went out to LA and I used to take meetings right after the Sundance Labs. I went out there with my script and I thought I was like the toast of the town. You know, I thought I was going to really, I thought they were going to, all the doors were going to be open.
Right.
But it was a very different time then. It was a very different industry then. Talk of diversity was not in the air. And different people that I would share the script with, everyone loved the script, but ultimately the writing was on the wall and they were not going to make the film. I remember one guy saying, you know, if we could get someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman on the poster, you know, maybe we could do, you know, fund this.
So, yeah, such a bad cliche, but go ahead.
Yeah. And it was very much like a different time period, you know? So I sort of tucked tail and ran and went back to Oklahoma and I was like, they're not going to make my films out there. So I had a bit of a career here in Oklahoma and I thought I could find the right support. And I did. I started making my films on a micro budget. He was barely making a living, honestly, but it was film to film. And I just knew that at some point the industry would change. And all I had to do was stick to my guns and keep making films. And I did that and it did change. And then I, you know, started coming back out to LA once streaming and TV was, I started getting jobs in that arena. And I could just feel the difference. You know, people were interested in stories and my stories. And they were also impressed that I'd made so many films on such a low budget, you know, and just kept working throughout the years. And I think that really actually helped me a lot. I think that helped me a lot, kind of give people confidence in hiring me.
Right. They thought this guy gets it done for a price.
That's right.
Which is important. I mean, you were on that in the bad days of, well, I would say bad old days, except they were more like 10 minutes ago. You know, it was that loop of, well, we don't think this will make money because Native films, I mean, it's always like baseball films don't make money. Native films don't make money.
Oh, yeah. I heard that multiple times that Native films don't make money. You know, I even heard like, well, this film's just a little too Indian, you know, or like this film's not Indian enough. We don't know where to kind of categorize it, you know? So it was very confusing to just say, hey, I just want to tell a regular story about people, you know?
People that you know.
That's right. People that I know and people that are in my family and, you know, not necessarily films about identity. It was just stories, you know, like that's what I wanted to express. And it wasn't what they wanted. But, you know, and I could have let that discourage me and stop, but I just knew that I needed to keep telling these stories.
So practically speaking, how did you put together those micro budgets?
I mean, it was so random, you know, it was like so many different ways. I mean, one time my producer who lived in Tulsa. He'd been rejected numerous times on trying to get funding for the film, calling everyone he knew. And he literally, out of frustration, yelled in his office. He worked in a law office. He yelled really loud, "Does anyone know anyone with any money?" Except he used a curse word. And this intern sort of rolled back in his chair and said, "I might." And literally introduced him to someone who was interested in funding the film. And that's how I got my first film funded.
I'm just thinking with a new approach, you're going to have people yelling out in offices all over the country, but go on.
Exactly. No, I know. And then another time there was just a guy with money that had approached my producer because they had a film that sort of fell apart, but the money was still there. And they were like, "Does Sterling have anything that he wants to make?" And I had written half a script and I was about halfway through it. And so I told my producer to lie. And I said, "Tell him that I'm working on a second draft and I'll get it to them in 2 weeks." And so I finished this script called Barking Water in a couple of weeks, sent it to them. And then I was making it a few months later.
Wow.
Exactly. It's pretty crazy.
This has been, I mean, I know that the show gets talked about so much because as the first, I imagine that's kind of gratifying that it's being talked about, but a little frustrating that you're still in that lens of the first.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's a blessing to be able to do that, but it doesn't stop with this show. I think that there's so many stories out there and so many Indigenous stories that need to be told that I hope that it opens the doors for all those other stories to be told.
Yeah, I hope that somebody does, because it is crazy. I think I read somewhere where you said it felt that, you know, it's diversity with Native coming in last as far as priorities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're a small portion of the population. And it's interesting because we've been a part of cinema from the beginning, though, right? Like even Edison films back in the day were depicting Native people dancing and different things. And so it's interesting that it's taken this long to really kind of tell our own story. I mean, you know, we were always the zombies in the Westerns. You know, we were sort of faceless and soulless, and we were in the way of Western expansion, and we needed to be eradicated. So we served a function in a way in American storytelling. But that function never allowed us to tell our own story. And so it's interesting and gratifying as well that we're finally being able to tell those stories.
Yeah. Now, you didn't want this to be like this, you know, you wanted it to be a comedy. And right. Taika and you, I gather, you know, being friends, talked about it, and at some point decided working together was a thing to do.
Right. You know, Taika had an overall deal at FX, and, you know, and we were friends, and I watched him sort of explode into this superstar. You know, it's like, it's a strange thing to watch your friend do that. But I never asked for help or like, you know, "Hey, can we do something?" I never did that because we were friends. And one day he said, "Hey, I have this overall deal at FX. Would you be interested in doing something?" And I was like, "Yeah." And so that's really all I needed to hear. And throughout the years, we had read each other's scripts and gave each other feedback. And so, you know, we took two ideas of scripts that we both had written and we sort of just mesh them together. And it really came out of that in one night. We just came up with it. And, you know, and I wrote some stuff down. I sent it to Taika the next day. And I think that it's pretty interesting that, I don't know, like, you know, I thought I wouldn't hear from him again for like a year and we'd talk about it then. But like all of a sudden, my agents are like, "You have an offer for a pilot." And it was like that fast. It was a few days later, you know, and I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, an executive at FX told me that he took it to FX and he said, "You have 45 minutes to say yes or no, and then I'm going out with it." And they were like, "Yes, yes."
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, to have that sort of swagger, you know, like, I don't know if I could do that, but, you know, Taika did it. So,
I mean, I sort of admire your reticence. It's such a thing that happens to people who do become that big that then people start tugging on their sleeve and asking for things. And you just were like, "I'm just going to sit and wait and do my thing. And maybe, you know, at some point, maybe we'll work together."
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, because I respected that space and friendship, obviously, like, you want to be surrounded by people you can trust, you know, and you also want to work with people you can trust. And so I think Taika appreciated that, you know, that I was always really just there for him if he needed to talk, as he was kind of exploding and talk through things. And similar, he was similar for me, you know? So it's truly been a really good friendship. And what better way to sort of celebrate that friendship than have a show together?
Coming up, Sterling Harjo tells us why he almost retired from the industry before creating Reservation Dogs.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Sterling Hardo, co-creator and showrunner of the FX comedy series Reservation Dogs. The show follows Indigenous teenager Bear and his friends as they deal with challenges big and small and dream of escaping a rundown town in Oklahoma. Hardo and his writers set out to put their own twist on the tropes that tend to show up in movies about natives that have generally been made by non-natives. When Bear and his buddies get mowed down by paintballs from a rival squad, Bear has a vision from a spirit warrior played by Dallas Goldtooth. The apparition claims to have fought bravely in the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Well, I didn't actually fight. I actually didn't even get into the fight itself. But I came over that hill real rugged, like, I saw Custer like that. That yellow hair, he was sitting there. Son of the morning star, that guy right there. I really hated him. So I went after him. But then the damn horse hit a gopher hole, rolled over and squashed me. I died there.
You know, like there's not a lot of Native actors in Hollywood beating down the door to play the next cliche or getting shot in front of a teepee sort of role, you know? So a lot of the Native actors and talent don't live in Hollywood, and you really have to do the work to go outside of Hollywood to find those. You have to go into the communities to find them. And Angelique Midthunder from Midthunder Casting, who casted the show, she was very down to do that. And we went to communities together and just met lots of kids all over. It was a really pretty beautiful experience. And also just reassuring, because there's so many talented actors out there, kids out there that can be in other shows or even this show later. I was impressed with how many great actors there were.
So Taika, having gotten you through the door, he then abandons you, goes off to make Thor. So you were just like, what? And then you had to, I think you called your friend Sierra Teller Ornelas.
Yeah, I called her, you know, because I mean, like I always tell people, like I found out what a showrunner was about a year before I became one. And the only other person I knew that was a showrunner was Sierra. She created Rutherford Falls. And I called her and I was like, hey, what am I doing? I remember asking her this. I was like, should I be like holding meetings or something? Like, is this up to me? What am I supposed to do? And so, you know, she really talked me through it. And I was also a little worried because I was giving all of the directors are friends of mine. And I was a little worried because I'm a director first and foremost. And I didn't want to step on my friends' toes as directors, you know, and I needed to know what the relationship between the showrunner and director usually is, because I hadn't worked on a lot of TV. I directed one episode of the show, The Magicians. So I didn't really know that relationship and how it works. So I was really just talking it through Sierra, like taking me through how this works. And she was really helpful, really super helpful in helping me get through that initial sort of freak out.
Did you meet her just from around? I mean, where did you guys connect?
It's sort of the same thing. I mean, I think that the Indigenous film community gravitates towards each other. We always end up at the same festivals.
Right.
It is a community. And that's how I met her. You know, we were just kind of there for each other as we were trying to navigate this business. And I remember telling her I was going to retire at one point. I was going to start a nonprofit. And, you know, she was kind of like, that's ridiculous.
You were going to retire? You just were like, okay, this is too hard?
When you don't know the business, it's hard to know how it's going to go or how you can walk into the room and get a show, you know, or whatever you're trying to do. When you're out of it and people aren't coming to you for work or for your ideas, it can feel pretty lonely, I think. And especially, you know, I was outside, I was in Oklahoma. I wasn't in LA. So I was even one more step removed from the industry. I didn't know how to make that happen. And honestly, it happened because I started working with, you know, Allison Anders, a friend of mine. She
did Gas Food Lodging and maybe Vita Loca. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she and I had been mentors together for the Sundance Native Lab and really bonded over music. And her daughter, Tiffany, is actually my music supervisor on Reservation Dogs right now. But we became good friends. And she said, you know, if you ever need an introduction to agents and managers, like I have a good team, let me know when you're coming out. And, you know, like It took a couple of years for me to even make a move on that. I just didn't know how it worked. You know, I always felt like agents, if they want to be your agent, they'll come for you. And now I realize it's a business. Like, I could have easily just went to them and said, hey, I want representation. They would have said yes or no. We would have had a meeting. I realize that now. But at the time, I didn't know that. And, you know, and finally, I was going out to LA. I knew something needed to change. It was around the time I was thinking about quitting. And I reached out to Allison and I said, hey, can you give me a introduction to your team? And she did. It was literally the only team that I met with. I met them. They were all great. You know, but they became my team. And I owe that to Allison. And really, it was that. Like, they started putting me in the room with people. Also, there's a filmmaker named Chris Fisher who literally was the first person to ever help me in my career. He's the one that offered. It was right after Bird and I met. I sent him a script. And Chris Fisher had a film at the Sundance Film Festival, midnight screening. And he wrote Bird and he said, I want to support Native filmmakers. Do you have anyone you want to bring out? I want to give my flight and hotel room to a filmmaker. And Bird said, I know the right person, picked me to come out. And it just gave me the experience of working with, they put me with a couple of writers. I worked with them. Years later, Chris Fisher gave me my first directing job on The Magicians.
Wow.
You know, there's people like that in my career that I feel like have been there and have helped me along the way, Tyke included. There's just a lot of people like that. And I try to do that myself. I try to pay that forward and, you know, give people work. And like I said, all my friends are directors on this show. And a couple of them are first-time TV directors. And being able to give them the opportunity, because that's all they needed was the opportunity. The talent was there. But being able to give them the opportunity was really a beautiful, fulfilling experience.
That is the power of a lot of things, networking and caring. And now let me circle back to the actual making of the show. You talked about, you know, as a new showrunner, how do I relate to these directors who are friends of mine and being, I guess, like, you know, how to be a boss. And I would imagine with the writers, I don't know how many of them were friends of yours, but I read that early on you went back twice to the writer's room and said, we're going to blow it up and redo. And I'm sure people must have just looked at you like, what?
Oh, man, they were very upset. You know, you wake up in the morning, like all the work that we did this week, we're taking it and we're throwing it out and we're starting over. And I would just have these like little panics at night where I would just be thinking about the show and be like, oh, this isn't the show. And so we'd come back and everyone was a little reluctant at first, but inevitably every time we would dig down and we would kind of go back to the source of what this show was. And we would find it. And we always felt better. I mean, the worst days were the days that we didn't find it. We inevitably would find it the next day. But like, it was essential to blow those things up and to start from scratch.
Now, one of the things I read, you were talking about previous depictions and that kind of thing. You said, we're tired of seeing ourselves out there wandering through forests, talking to ghosts. And there's always flute music. And I get what you were saying. And yet, I will note that in the show, there is a wandering through forests. There are ghosts or that's kind of. So somehow you're just doing it your way, right?
I think it's turning the trope on its head and saying, you know, like, isn't it funny that this is what you thought we were like? And we were kind of at one point, but we're now going to let you in on the joke and we're going to all laugh at it together. I think it's a way to bring people into the show to get the humor.
I mean, there is also something of a tribute to the past.
That's right. There's definitely a tribute to the past in that because, you know, those tropes are pulled from reality. We are honoring the past. We're also talking about cinema of the past as well and the depictions of us. And, you know, if you talk to anyone, you say, like, tell me the first thing you think of when you think Native American. Well, that's the image that they would come up with, unless they're watching Reservation Dogs now, and they might have new versions of what that would be. And I think that that's the beautiful thing about storytelling like this.
Sterling Harjo is the creator of the FX series Reservation Dogs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
And that's The Business. Melissa Yeager-Miller produced and edited today's program with help this week from Katie Gilchrist and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. Starting next week, you can hear new episodes of The Business Podcast every Thursday from wherever you listen. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.